year, the CDC released new recommendations for HIV testing in healthcare settings. They encompassed one set of guidelines for pregnant women and another for adults and adolescents aged 13 to 64 who are not pregnant. In the interest of time, I'll be leaving the recommendations for pregnant women for a future presentation. The new recommendations contain four major changes from previously published guidelines. First, the CDC recommends that all patients be tested for HIV as a routine part of healthcare. An opt-out method is to be used, so the patient needs to explicitly say he or she does not want to be tested. Second, people who are considered high risk should be tested at least once a year. Third, written consent should no longer be necessary for HIV testing, and providers can consider consent for medical care to be enough. And fourth, the CDC says that prevention counseling does not need to be part of HIV testing process unless someone tests positive or is negative and high risk. Now, in thinking about this policy or any policy, we should ask ourselves a few questions. Namely, what are the goals of this policy? Will the policy help us to achieve these goals? And finally, are they the right goals to be pursuing? The CDC explained their goals in a teleconference the day before these recommendations were released. They want to diagnose people who are not aware of their HIV-positive status, and they want to reduce the stigma of HIV testing by making it a normal part of healthcare. I think it would be hard to argue that these are bad objectives, but through the process of thinking about these recommendations and examining the literature, I have concluded that the end product, these recommendations, are flawed in several ways. To start, the new testing process advises a streamlined version of the HIV testing process. This was in response to the fact that healthcare providers were not offering HIV testing to patients because the whole process, getting consent, pre-test counseling, and post-test counseling took too long. However, I would say that they've gone too far in the other direction by eliminating steps that are meant to give patients the care that they deserve. Now, with the issue of written versus non-written informed consent, different states have different laws. And personally, I don't think that requiring written consent is a bad thing. I've read accounts from several providers and researchers who don't believe that written informed consent is a barrier to testing. One good thing about written consent is that it forces the provider to initiate some kind of conversation with the patient. Although I did read about models using oral consent that sounds like they might be sufficient. One problem that I have with the CDC recommendations is that you have to read very carefully to see that they actually do advise sharing basic information with patients about HIV infection and testing before performing a test. There's one sentence about this in the guidelines, which I included on the slide, but it's hidden somewhere around page 10, and none of the summary sheets produced by the CDC make this clear. In contrast, the May 2007 HIV counseling and testing recommendations by the World Health Organization say almost the same thing, but are much more explicit. For the typical primary care doctor who won't be reading through the CDC guidelines carefully, it would be reasonable to think that you don't even have to explain the difference between a positive and negative HIV test result. My major objection, though, is that they propose treating prevention counseling as a separate intervention from HIV testing and advise not doing any prevention counseling with people who test negative unless they are high risk. If we only think about HIV testing as a way to identify people who are positive, then it's true that there's no need to do post-test counseling when someone tests negative. But if we think of it as a prevention measure, the combination of counseling and testing is an opportunity to teach about how HIV is transmitted and how a person can lower his or her risk. Even brief counseling sessions that are client-centered have been found to lower STD incidence and increase condom use among HIV-negative patients. Another important point that a few people have raised in journal articles is that not doing post-test counseling with people who test negative could actually increase risk-taking behavior by letting patients think that they are not at risk. We saw that one of the major goals of this policy is to reduce the stigma of HIV testing. The CDC proposes to do this by testing everyone regardless of a patient's risk factors. This is how they justify considering prevention counseling a separate intervention from HIV testing. However, the recommendations demand that providers know whether one is high risk for two situations. First, post-test counseling is only recommended with negative test results if a patient is high risk. And second, follow-up HIV screenings are advised to take place at the clinician's discretion based on the patient's risk factors. If there is no conversation about risk, it will be all too easy for the clinician to make assumptions based on other factors like race, ethnicity, class, or sexual orientation. As they are written, the CDC guidelines on HIV testing cannot be fully implemented for several reasons. First, a majority of states have laws related to written informed consent or pre- or post-counseling requirements that would prevent providers from following the recommendations. The guidelines briefly refer to these legal barriers and in a couple of sentences suggest that states address the conflict by changing their laws. In the past year, though, very few states have taken steps to change the laws on HIV testing, which might indicate that they are happy with the laws as they are. The second barrier to implementation is the monitoring and evaluation burden placed on healthcare facilities. Since routine HIV screening has never been done here on a nationwide basis, the CDC doesn't really know how successful it will be. So it is asking providers to track the yield of new diagnoses, monitor costs, and evaluate whether patients diagnosed with HIV are linked to and retained in care. Obviously, there isn't any additional funding to support these initiatives. We have to keep in mind that these recommendations are for both large hospitals and small primary care practices, and it's unrealistic to expect that providers can automatically make this kind of monitoring happen. The third barrier relates to linkage of care. When someone tests positive for HIV, many steps have to be taken to address the patient's immediate needs, such as referrals, confirmatory testing, and counseling. In a small medical practice, or one that is not used to dealing with HIV, it can be very disruptive to the flow of the day. Obviously, it's valuable from the patient's perspective and from a prevention perspective to discover one's HIV status early, but I don't think that the CDC recommendations adequately acknowledge the burden to providers. The challenge here is that on one hand, plenty of people are HIV positive who don't think they're at risk, and we want to get them into care as early as possible. On the other hand, a counseling and testing intervention should be carried out in a way that is fair to patients so that they understand the implications of HIV testing and receive prevention counseling. The conclusion I have come to is that when resources are limited, policies should be realistic and targeted so that they can have the most impact. Because there are no additional resources being allocated to support the CDC's testing recommendations, I think a better approach would be to assume that everyone is at risk for HIV, but based on risk factors, assume that some people are at higher risk than others. As needed, resources should be allocated to target those at higher risk. This view is very much in line with the World Health Organization's May guidelines on HIV counseling and testing. Boston Medical Center, where I work, offers an example of an innovative hospital-based HIV counseling and testing program. BMC is an urban safety net hospital with more than 50% of patients with income levels under $17,000 a year. The HIV counseling and testing staff consists of a program manager, a data coordinator, and 13 full-time HIV counselors. Many of our HIV patients receive their diagnosis from our counseling and testing staff. You can see that our HIV patient population is largely male and primarily non-white. Our staff tests 7,000 to 8,000 people a year, and seroprevalence has been between 1 and 1.5% for the last several years. Our HIV counseling and testing program is almost entirely government-funded, with support from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health and the CDC. The program's headquarters is a drop-in testing center, and counselors also test patients throughout the hospital and at a number of community-based sites. In the three sites that are underlined, inpatient services, primary care clinic, and the urgent care center, the counselors test people based on hierarchical routine testing. Hierarchical routine testing is a way to test as many people as resources allow while focusing on those at highest risk. Because of this strategy, counselors can link patients to care immediately, and we see a high proportion of new cases with low reported risk. As you can see, in all three sites, at least a quarter of those diagnosed with HIV were considered to be low risk. Our urgent care center diagnoses more patients with HIV than either inpatient or the primary care clinic, which makes sense because urgent care sees more patients who don't have regular doctors and are a generally higher risk population. In conclusion, I think the United States' HIV prevention efforts would be better served by a set of CDC recommendations that are feasible within the parameters of existing resources. Boston Medical Center's HIV testing program is an example of how hospitals can implement a modified form of routine testing while using funding strategically. Thank you.